Welcome to the Nicholas Natale Show, where we chat with entrepreneurs, experts, and entertainers to help you live a more fulfilling life and take your business to the next level. Today, we're chatting with Chris Doe. Chris Doe is an Emmy Award-winning designer, director, CEO, and chief strategist of Blind and the founder of The Future, an online education platform with the mission of teaching 1 billion people how to make a living doing what they love. He currently serves as the chairman of the board for the Society for the Promotion of Japanese Animation and as an advisor to Saleshood. He's incredible. I have an insane amount of respect and admiration for Chris. This episode will be completely uninterrupted. I'm talking absolutely ad-free, but the deal is, if we're going uninterrupted, before we dive in, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and share this episode with a friend that you know would benefit from it. These shares and reviews help me reach out to guests, which in turn bring more value to you on how to live a fulfilling life. Riddle of the week, what do you call a factory that makes okay products? Stay tuned to the end of the episode to find out. That was the intro. Now here is the episode. Hello and welcome. This is the Nicholas Natale Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Natale. Today we have a very special guest, Chris Doe. Chris, how's it going?
It's going well, Nicholas. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Here's where I want to start. We have a lot to cover, so I'm going to dive right in.
Let's do it.
Tell me if this is true. I've heard you speak about how growing up as a middle child, you take on the role of a caretaker in areas of your life. And because of that, dealing with confrontation can come with difficulties. Certain passive-aggressive people can push your buttons from time to time. From the outside looking in, I feel as though you're an expert at providing tough love and constructive feedback. Where do those two worlds butt heads, confrontation and constructive feedback, and how do you overcome it?
Great question. Way to just jump right into it. I think it's one thing to be able to give people advice and it's another thing to do it yourself. And I think we all can understand that, right? Like we can say you shouldn't smoke or drink and you should work out and you should be kind to others. But then in our own homes, we smoke and we drink, we don't work out, and we're unkind to the people that are in our lives. So let's separate those two things. So seeing me tell people and give people tough love, and you can see that, and that's not an issue. But when it comes to my own boundaries, it's something I wasn't even aware of, that I thought it was being a creative person that was conflict averse, like to steer away from any kind of potential tension. It made hiring people and firing people and disciplining people very difficult for me. Later on, through some family therapy work, I realized something with my therapist who said, "You're a caretaker." I said, "No, I'm not. I am not a caretaker." I deny that accusation. Yeah. Because in my home, like where like with my parents or with my spouse, they all try to take care of me. They know how precious my time is and they know how busy I am. So everybody's running around trying to help me. Even my kids, like, "Dad, can we take care of this for you?" So I was thinking, how could I be the caretaker? So she rewound the tape and asked me a couple of questions about my childhood, which was really eye-opening to me. She asked me like three questions, like, "Who mowed the lawn?" I'm like, "Me." "Who helped your mom with the dishes?" I'm like, "Me." "And who would clean the bathroom or do the laundry?" I'm like, "Oh my God, where does this come from?" And so, you know, there's a lot of birth order stuff that's going on here in childhood development that cannot be overcome, that is part of your DNA. So the realization of that made me hyper aware of like when I was acting as a middle child, trying to get others to approve me, to like me, to see me, to notice me, those tendencies would pop up.
It's such a strange thing, a nature and nurture. I'm the youngest of five, but the age gap between my siblings, the closest one is 10 years apart.
Wow.
I fall into a weird category of getting the perks of being the youngest sibling in some aspects and also getting the perks of being an only child, but also having perks of siblings. It's interesting how we fall into those frameworks without even knowing it sometimes.
Yeah, what you're talking about is birth order and the gap between your siblings. Those things matter a lot. When you have children really close together, I'm no child therapist or psychologist here, but they compete for resources and attention. And there's a lack of maturity. So when younger brother or sister is getting some attention, you're going to get pounded on because they think it's unfair. And life was pretty good until you walked into the world and they received most of the attention. But when 10 years go by, your next oldest sibling is 10 years older than you. You're not playing the same things. You're not looking at the same things. And so hopefully they take on more of like a surrogate father or mother's role where they're really looking out for you. And not always, of course, but the age gap matter a lot. So for example, the gap between my older brother and I is 4 years and my younger brother and I is less than a year. Right. So it got really close. So we're always competing for attention and resources. Whereas my older brother was like my surrogate father. And we never went to the same schools because as he was a freshman in college, I was a freshman in high school, but he always looked out for me.
That's incredible. And my mother fell into that category as well. And reflecting on that, I feel pretty lucky in that sense. But speaking of fathers, let's have a beautiful segue here about your father. Your parents immigrated from Vietnam in April of 1975. And from the research I've found on your dad, he sounds like an incredible person. He went from not having a college education, working as a busboy that didn't speak English, to retiring as a chief engineer at a semiconductor company in Silicon Valley. Your dad's the oldest of 10 brothers and sisters, took on the head of the household role when he was a teenager. He's logical, he's pragmatic, and he can seemingly fix anything, including an electronic game you borrowed as a kid. What is a characteristic of your dad's you have chosen to hold on to, and what is a characteristic that was given to you, and maybe it's some of what we're already discussing, that you've chosen to work through?
I think my dad is probably the single most influential person in my life. And I didn't realize it until much later on in life because I was at odds with my father at times. Because like I said, my brother and I always got into arguments and my dad almost always sided with my younger brother, which created a lot of resentment in me. And it's not until I understand his history and how he was raised and what roles he had to take on that it makes a lot of sense. And understanding his history gave me a lot of perspective on the understanding of that. My dad would oftentimes... whenever we got in trouble, and I got in trouble here and there, but he would sit down and he'd just lecture us for hours at a time. And it was just really rough for me because I was like, just take the belt to me and let's get this over with because I want to go back and read comics, you know?
Yeah,
I'm good with that because that's over in an instant. But my dad used, I didn't know the term at that time, but it was Socratic questioning and Socratic reasoning with me. So he'd ask me lots of questions. He'd ask me to play both parts. To the person that I hurt and then to see it from their point of view. And that's the last thing you want to do as a hurt child yourself. It's like, why would I want to take the other person's perspective? I'm the victim here. But that's something that I've learned from my dad. Another thing that I love about my dad is he's fairly objective and neutral. He's very fact-based and fact-driven. And so he doesn't let his emotions get in the way of like what's going on. Now, I also learned that he had to repress his emotions because when he was a teenager, his father died. And so when his father died, I think he had to emotionally grow up really, really fast and it stunted his emotional intelligence, I think. Or maybe he just controlled it. And now he's a super emotional person, but back in his formative years and kind of taking care of his brothers and raising us as kids, I think he held back. And I see that emotions are powerful tools to use and to utilize, but we have to know when to regulate and when they serve us and when they work against us. So I get that from my dad. And the last thing, and there are many more things, but the last thing I can share with you is his sense of hard work was the way forward and to delay short-term gratification for long-term goals. He would tell me this over and over again. You have a lifetime to live, a lifetime to enjoy yourself, but if you put in the work up front, you'll reap the rewards, your life will be better. And he explained it to me this way. You probably already know this because you've listened to the episode. But if we take all the hard work and we spread it across 30 or 40 years of our life, we never achieve excellence and we're always bumping towards like that median arc. But if we take that effort of the 30 years and we put up in front like the first 5 years and we work like animals and we go to school and we make lots of sacrifice, then where we bump up to is a much higher place and then we can coast for the rest of our lives. Now, he didn't tell me the other part. The other part is once you learn how to elevate and bump up, you really get used to that kind of pace and you never drop back down. And so I think if he had told me all that, then I wouldn't have bought in on the program. But luckily, he knew how to tell me that information in a way that I could process it.
Wow, that's super valuable information. Did you ever find yourself getting caught up in a pace that you felt like this is not sustainable forever and hitting a big wall?
Yeah, I think it's like the arrogance of youth where you're in your late teens, to early to mid 20s, where you think this stamina that you have, this endurance and this energy lasts forever. And you push yourself so hard. And I remember in college, it was a badge of honor to say, how many nights have you stayed up in a row this semester? Yeah. And I would completely dismiss anyone who told me they've never stayed up all night. I was like, you're phoning it in. You really are. But you can see how destructive that is on your body. I realized as I was getting a little bit older, the recovery period of doing multiple all-nighters was taking longer and longer. And I was starting to feel the effects. And it does also put you in harm's way because when you stay up all night, you start hallucinating. And I used to do that. Like the scariest moment was when I literally, when I was in college, I woke up driving on the wrong side of the road.
Wow.
And that was like shocking my system. Like, oh my God, I have to get this together.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Oh, that's intense.
Yeah. I've had some scary moments. Thank God I'm still here, that I didn't, you know, go into a head-on collision with another car, oh God forbid, or just into a lamppost or something.
Was that a wake-up moment for you and to change your behavior? Because in my life, I've had situations that have been seemingly drastic to similar incidents, like mortality, my life is in danger, and yeah. It's still, sometimes it wasn't enough for me to change the behavior still. It still took time after that. Or was that an immediate like, okay, this is bad. I gotta start sleeping.
No, it's not instant. I gotta tell you, because you tell yourself all kinds of stories. You deny it.
Like, justify it.
I'm really tired, but I gotta get through this and I gotta pull over and get some coffee or something. I gotta develop different systems, right? I'm okay when I'm doing the work, but as you know, when you drive, you kind of enter into a state of self-hypnosis and you can fall asleep pretty quickly, especially for me. Like when my brain's not engaged, I will fall asleep right away. And so I think what had happened to me was a very gradual process. Like in my last year in school, sometimes I was stressing out over deadlines and then I had to check in with myself, like, is this class really that important that you're going to go through this and torture yourself this way? And then I would just snap back and say, you know, it's not, it's okay. There is some personal and professional embarrassment that I didn't live up to my potential, but it's probably better than dying.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I feel like that can go across to multiple things, always checking in to see if our priorities are in line.
Yep.
There are only a handful of things in life that are worth staking our lives for, I'd say that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about in that teen, early age, you're attending San Diego Community College, probably around the time you met Candace Lopez and possibly D'Angelo from Philosophy 101. And that's just a shot in the dark. You were in a toxic relationship. Tension was growing as you lived with your older brother and his girlfriend. And you had a night where the metaphorical child passed and the man was born, where you said, I'll do whatever it takes to prove every person who doubts me wrong. Give me insight into that pivotal moment in your life and how much of that mindset that came alive that night still drives your internal psyche today.
I think it was a confluence of multiple things that were happening to me at the same time that broke me emotionally. I was going through a rough patch with my girlfriend. I think we had just broken up. My relationship with my older brother, who had always looked after me, was kind of becoming very distant to a point in which I thought I hated this person. And I was just very immature in the reaction. I think what he was doing was like, kid, you got to grow up. I can't be doing all this stuff. And you're getting really annoying right now. But I just saw it as like this entitled brat point of view. So I was like, screw you, screw your girlfriend. I can't wait to get out of here. I'm done with this, right? Yeah. And the thing that pushed me over the edge was I was having a conversation with my mom. I remember crying and saying, this sucks. I hate my brother and I don't want to be here anymore. And then my mom said something, which in a very subtle way was more hurtful than anything that somebody with intention could say to me, which was, maybe this dream of going to this private art school is not for you. Come home. And she was trying to comfort me. But what she was saying was, let's just give up on this pursuit. I can see that it's tearing you apart. And that's not something I wanted to hear from my mom, because it sounded like, I don't believe in you anymore. I don't believe in this dream. She was just trying to comfort me. But that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So I remember that night, I was having some pretty dark thoughts about myself, about whether life was worth pursuing or continuing. And I was just laying on the floor having that moment, like in that fetal position where I cried so much. I'm like, I think I can't cry anymore because of all these emotional things happening. And then that's when I had that outer body experience where I'm kind of floating above myself, looking at myself with a lot of judgment, I think, saying like, this is not the person we promised ourselves we would be when we were a child. This is not the dream. What is happening to you right now? And I could see pretty clearly that there were two paths to go. One was darkness. And one was a story of redemption and just proving to people that I, if I focus my mind, can achieve anything. And I had to make that decision. So that night, quite literally, just it happened in one night. I woke up the next morning, said, I'm going to get my act together. And at first, I think I was motivated by something very petty, like anger and resentment and thoughts of like, oh, I'm going to show you. I'm going to prove it to you. You guys don't know what you're talking about. From my girlfriend to my brother, his girlfriend, and then my mom saying like, it's okay to not have those big dreams anymore. I was going to prove them wrong. And I got super hyper-focused. And I think a lot of decisions were made in that day. I think I was like either 18 or 19 at that point. And I just decided, you know what? being this emotional roller coaster, kind of like being on that emotional roller coaster, was not serving me well. And so I wanted to temper those wild emotional arcs, the highs and the lows. So I decided, you know, I need to be a more rational person. I need to be much more goal oriented. And that is pretty much how I live to this day, some 30 plus years later.
Oh my goodness. Is there still a desire to prove people wrong, or has something switched a little bit in the drive? Or do you still have that part of you?
Oh, I still have that. And I think some people look at it that and see it as a negative thing. And it can be a negative thing if that's the only thing that you want to do. If your only motivation is to hurt other people in the sense yeah. that I'll prove you wrong and I'll make you shut up, right?
Yeah.
But there's this documentary, it's called The Last Dance, and it features Michael Jordan. And you can hear accounts from people who played on his team and against him, how little things, just things that were even totally imaginary, these slights, that he would use to motivate himself and play sick and have his highest scoring game. And I see myself in that way. And not that I'm trying to conflate myself or aggrandize myself to Michael Jordan's level, but we all need things to motivate us. Some people are motivated by reward. Some people are motivated by anger or some darker energy. And I'm a combination of both. I see my future and it's this vision that I have and I'm propelled towards it. But I also use anything and everything to say, like, you know what? I'll show you. You'll see. And I don't wish them harm. I would never like hold it above them. I would never rub it in their face once I get to that place. But then I'm just using anything I can to push me forward, because we all have those days when we think maybe today's not the day. Maybe that goal wasn't worth achieving and we let ourselves off the hook. I don't ever want to let myself off the hook.
Yeah, it's just fuel. That's what it is. It's fueling the right fire.
Yeah.
And that's such a good point. The Last Dance, his whole motto throughout that documentary is, and I took that personally. He didn't say hello to me at dinner and I took that personally. So right. I went and dropped 50 on his team.
Right.
But we need those moments. I like your point of, even if it is imaginary, if it can fuel you to perform something positive, it's worthwhile.
Yeah. You know, we try to grow our YouTube channel, and we did this as a ceremony at the office where we would paste up every YouTuber that we thought was in our lane that had more subscribers than us. And we would just put them all along the wall, like the FBI's most wanted. And some of them we didn't like, some people we didn't like. And some people were like, those are our friends, but we just put them up. And one by one, and my team would do this, and they bought into this whole competitive energy. They would go up and they would just put an X under their face as soon as we passed them. And you know, it's a difficult thing when somebody is ahead of you two or three laps. Like, not only do you have to run at your pace, but you have to run faster than your pace to eventually catch them. And the thing that killed us was if anybody was behind us and they lapped us, we're like, what are we doing? Team, let's get together here. And we would do that. And we were like, they would come into the room like, Chris, we have something to tell you. We just passed X subs. And they would get a chair, or not a chair, step ladder, because it was pretty high up, right? They would get a step ladder and they'd get the marker and just X them out. We're done.
That is incredible. It's awesome to foster that type of culture too, because outside of sports, we don't see it that often in a healthy competitive light. I mean, maybe in certain instances, I hear of entrepreneurs talking about, I got the bigger deal than I was thinking, but to have right. a whole organization kind of come together in that way, I feel like that builds a lot of team spirit in a sense.
Well, having clear goals and celebrating your milestones is an important part of building habit. So I remember seeing, I think it was in The Social Network, where Zuckerberg was counting how many active subscribers or users on the Facebook platform. And when they hit a million, they're, woo, we did it. And then 10 million, and then 100 million, then a billion. I was like, okay, that's how they became one of the most influential platforms on the web. And I get that. And I like that. It's good to have soft goals, like where we don't know when we get there, but it's also good to have some really hardcore, tangible goals where you can take a marker and you say, we did it or we did not do it. There's no gray here.
Yeah, that's true. I want to go back to the boundaries portion that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of in line, I suppose, in regards to scaling. So your uncle ran a liquor store while you were in middle school. You bought yep. candy from him at wholesale price, turned it around, dispersed it to other kids. They would sell it. And then you'd hire kids to go pick up the wrappers that kids were throwing on the ground after yep. eating the candy. Now, this isn't a question about scaling a business, because I feel like that example I mentioned proves that exactly what to do there. But I'm curious how you've been able to scale your boundaries alongside your business as it's grown. Because from what I know, there's layers in between now what information gets to you. And most of those conversations start with, hey, Chris, sorry to bother you. how have you baked in boundaries and then a culture of embracing decision-making, owning failure into your business?
Okay. The way that I interpret your question, I'm going to try my best to answer. And if I don't hit it, just redirect me. Okay.
Got it.
I abhor meetings. I don't want to do any meetings unless it's absolutely necessary. While simultaneously, and it seems a contradiction here, I want to make sure everybody feels like they can call me at any given time and talk to me about something that they can't resolve with other people. And this is a very delicate balance, because if you make yourself so available, every single person sidesteps their manager and their manager's manager and goes straight to you to resolve all their problems. The way I look at it is, unless this problem cannot be solved by anybody else and no one can make the decision, then bring it to me. And if someone like your superior is giving you a hard time and you just can't work with them, you've tried everything within your power, not as your first step, then reach out to me. Let's have a conversation. And so we have a very specific span of effective management policy. And there are a handful of people that pretty much run the company for me. Ben Burns is our chief operating officer. Essentially, he runs the entire company. And then there's Amy, who reviews client relationships, brand relationships. She reads the contract. She makes sure that we're doing the right kinds of things and making sure that we're not stepping out of bounds on a legal or ethical way that would be incongruous with our company. And she keeps me on track too. She's like, sometimes you're being too flexible and sometimes you're being too loose here. And so she's my guidepost. And I've worked with Amy for over 20 years now, maybe not close to 20 years. And it's been an incredible relationship. So those are the people who tend to be the point people. And then there's other people, of course, but most of the information gets funneled through them. And then the content team, they meet together. There's Mark and he helps to direct the team. But of course, I'm having dialogue with each content creator that's helping me on a regular basis as needed.
What was your time, I don't want to say time management, but really, how has it changed and grown and your strategy changed as the business has grown, especially if Amy's been there since the beginning? Has she been influential in being like, Chris, you're taking on too many meetings, or Chris, stop saying yes to these things because you told me you didn't want to do that and now we're doing it? Things like that.
Yeah. So the interesting story about Amy is she's been with me for two companies now. So she was with me when we were running a service company called Blind. And then towards the end of that, she left for personal reasons and had been away from us for years. We were building up the future. And my wife, who was then handling all the financial legal stuff, it was just too much for her. And it was not a good way to have a relationship with your wife and run your company. And so she's like, you need to hire somebody. And I was thinking, I wonder if Amy's available. And so I reached out to her and she goes, well, Chris, just as a matter of fact, I've been thinking about my next move. And at that point, she was working with an accounting firm. And I said, well, I don't want to create trouble for you, but if you're thinking about leaving, we'd love to have you back in some new capacity. And yeah, Amy is that kind of person who, Chris, I know you agreed to this, but I'm going to negotiate with the client, the partner, the sponsor to make sure that the terms are more agreeable to the way I know how you want to work. Because I'm more likely to say yes, and Amy's going to then make sure that I don't get myself into trouble and overextend myself. So for example, I could agree to say 12 deliverables. She's going to cut that down to 6. I might have agreed to do it for say 40K. She's going to ask for 80. That's just how she works.
Have you ever found yourself having difficulty, let's say, advocating for yourself in regards to, let's say there's something like, yeah, this is a $48,000 contract, and Amy comes in and says, Chris, look at this. This is an $80,000 contract. What are you talking about? How have you seen yourself grow and transform in that realm of self-advocation?
Well, it goes both ways. So sometimes Amy will say, like, I think the most we can ask for this is for 75. And I'm like, Amy, this is a lot of work. I don't think so. And then we get on the phone and I say, just let me lead this one. And there's one instance where we went into the conversation thinking, we'll ask them for a $75,000 sponsorship opportunity. As we were talking, I kind of just stepped in and did my thing. And we walked away with a $120,000 deal.
Nice.
So I say that because sometimes there's a personal connection that I have. And that's usually where I'm not as good of an advocate for myself, because I'm thinking, I like these people. And they're my friends and they're broke and I don't want to do this to them. I want to support them. And Amy will do that sometimes for me to say, like, Chris, you know, I think we can do this for less. So it's like countering whatever it is that I'm doing. And sometimes when we both agree, then we know this is exactly the approach we need to take.
Yeah, a good balance. Good back and forth. Good give and take.
Yeah, I think so. Just like the way I would have with my wife, except for this is like a business relationship.
Yeah, the work capacity.
Yeah.
Without projecting, I'm going to throw a little shot in the dark here. As a kid, you moved about every year and a half. And I projection here, that it may have given you the ability to recognize when to move toward where the opportunity is. And I'm curious, what structure do you have in place within your business that allows you to pivot quickly? And what does it look like when you decide it's time to shift? Like we're focusing on branding and we should really be focusing on web design now, things like that.
I think to address the childhood part, the observation that you're having there, I didn't look for opportunities when I was a kid. The only opportunity I was looking for is who am I going to have lunch with when we move and how am I going to reestablish my network of friends because it's going to be a rough, rough year. And I was dreading that, right? The first day of school when you're introduced to a class where everybody already knows each other. Because sometimes my parents would move middle of the year or sometimes they would move during the summer, which made the transition a little bit easier. But I got to tell you, it was one of the most discomforting things. I just felt like I'm always the outsider and this sucks. You know, as I was moving up in the social hierarchy of junior high or high school or whatever it was, it's like, we're going to reset the table again. I'm like, oh, this is really rough. So it did affect me in ways that weren't positive. It made me feel like I should not spend time building friendships. This is pre-cell phone, pre-internet, and pre-Facebook or anything. So I lost touch with people really fast because if I didn't see them at school, it's not like I'm calling up Billy and saying, hey, what's up? It was pretty much one day either Billy's gone or one day I'm gone. And there wasn't a lot of communication in between. And we did not stay in touch. And so that was very dysregulating for me growing up. What I realized later on is that moving so often and having an unstable childhood in that way made me much more resilient, less likely to become complacent. And it created this mindset or this belief that anything can change, so we should always be ready for change. And so that leads you to the future, which is how can I prime myself to look for opportunities when they appear? And mostly because, one, it was a pretty normal thing for me to lose everything. Meaning friendships, relationships, social structure, goodwill with people, even relationships with teachers. And so I'm not attached to things. So if we're doing something, I don't care how long we're working on it and how hard the team's been working at it. If it's not working anymore, I say, just pull the plug. And it's very difficult for people to do. I'll give you an example, and I'm going to abstract some of the information here, okay? I'm advising several companies right now. And I think my role is to help bring fresh ideas to them. And I do bring ideas that I think, and I'm trying to be objective here, are good ideas that are new business ventures that could make them millions, if not tens of millions of dollars. And they think it's a good idea. But when I check in with them 3, 6, 9 months, 2 years later, nothing has changed. And I know why, because as humans, I think it's very hard for us to break habits that we know are not serving us well, because inertia or momentum works for you and it works against you. So take, for example, if there's an organization and they have, say, 50 people working for them, and they've been working on some idea or project that they've been refining for the last 2 years, if a new idea is presented, how are they going to deal with this new idea? They're going to have to tell each and every single person, what we did in the last 2 years doesn't count anymore. And all our clients and all the promises we made, we're going to break them right now, and we're going to go for this new idea. And I don't have any evidence that this new idea is going to work. I just have a belief that it will and have faith that it will. So this is why very rarely do we just change and shift gears. Now, I'm not saying I'm unique in this regard, but when I see us doing something and it's not working, I just say, let's stop doing that. That's not serving us anymore. And it can create a little bit of chaos with my team because they're saying, like, 4 months ago, you said this was it. I said, yeah, I agree. This is not your fault. And we're going to try many things. And I have this philosophy that we may have 10 ideas to try, 8 of them will fail. And that's just part of the culture of innovation, that there's a lot of waste. It's wasteful to be innovative, but we only need 1 or 2 of the 10 ideas to work. But what we don't want to do is get stuck on idea number 7 when idea 8 was going to change the game for us. And it's hard for people to think like that. But over time, I think I tried to attract the same people with the same kind of mindset that I have, that they're willing to say, you know what? Okay, we don't even know if it's going to work, but let's go for it. and just quickly become detached. And I think that's how you find the opportunities.
The detachment. And it also sounds like best idea wins if something comes up. And also, you're not saying, we've worked on this thing for so long, it's pretty good, and this other idea is okay, so maybe we'll just skip and try it. It's like, this is a better idea. We're jumping ship because this is a better idea. Even if we don't know the exact outcome, we can place this idea higher. Is that correct?
Yeah. And you know, I've read books on this where I may be misquoting some of these concepts, but I think the core of it's there, where we're more motivated by the things that we lose than by the things we have to gain. So if I tell you I have a new business idea that'll make us $3 million, you might be like, okay, that sounds pretty cool. Or if I say we're going to lose $8 million doing this other thing, then they're more likely to change. Yeah. But this works both ways, right? So when I present a new idea, what happens is people are afraid that we're going to lose whatever we have, even though it's not ideal. So they start to make compromises. They say, well, why don't we try it this way? And they take very measured steps. And my way of thinking is we'll never know if this works unless we do a clean cut and we just go for it and we stick to it and we give it our best shot. And if and when it doesn't work out, because there's a high likelihood it won't work out, we don't say, well, that sucks, we're lame, and we're going to revert back to the other plan. No, we invent a new plan and we keep trying again and again until we make this new reality a reality.
It's the fierceness. You have to have both. You can't go in halfway on a new idea. Otherwise, you're destining yourself for that new idea is going to fail anyway. So then what's the point?
Yeah. Yeah. Guy Kawasaki talks about this in one of his TED Talks, that in order to innovate, you have to jump the curve. You can't just iterate yourself to a more innovative future. And so what people do is they make tiny little improvements and they're afraid of destroying their existing business model, that they can't grab the opportunity that's right in front of them. One of the classic examples in American history in terms of companies and brands, and it's the tragic story, is the one of Kodak. And some people know this, some people don't, but Kodak actually invented the technology to make digital cameras. They came up with the idea for a digital sensor. And I forget who invented it within the company. When it was presented to the powers that be, they looked at it and said, this is a great idea. We're not going to do it because it's going to cannibalize the celluloid film market, which we dominate. And this is like a hallmark of American brands, and we're not going to let that go. And so what happens is the technology that they invented was then used by other companies, Sony, Canon, Panasonic, and now they dominate the photography market, and Kodak is like a blip. And in fact, Kodak went into bankruptcy, but it's one of those legacy brands that there's nostalgia for. So maybe it will always be supported, but it's never going to be the company it was.
Because they didn't jump ship. They're afraid.
They're afraid of losing the market that they dominated.
Yeah, fear. That's terrible. That was the episode. You just listened to it. Be sure to tune in for part two. Chris will be dropping even more knowledge bombs. Part two is releasing on Monday at 6 a.m. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share this episode with a friend that you appreciate. Let them know you love them. It'll take 5 seconds and is a great use of your screen time. Also, I'm on Instagram at Nicholas Talley. I reply to every single DM, so slide in them. The real reason you're still here, you want to know the answer to the riddle of the week. What do you call a factory that makes okay products? A satisfactory. Satisfactory, because they're just okay, you know, it's just okay. Thank you for tuning in. See you this upcoming Monday at 6 a.m. Be kind, be strong, be disciplined, be absolutely obsessed. Bye-bye. Bye.